We again failed to find work the next day, and it was 3 weeks before the luck changed. My 200 francs saved me from trouble about the rent, but everything else went as badly as possible. Day after day, Boris and I went up and down Paris, drifting at 2 miles an hour through the crowds, bored and hungry, and finding nothing. One day, I remember, we crossed the Seine 11 times. We loitered for hours outside service doorways, and when the manager came out, we would go up to him ingratiatingly, cap in hand. We always got the same answer. They did not want a lame man, nor a man without experience. Once, we were very nearly engaged. While he spoke to the manager, Boris stood straight upright, not supporting himself with his stick, and the manager did not see that he was lame. "Yes," he said, "we want 2 men in the cellars. Perhaps you would do, come inside." Then Boris moved, and the game was up. "Ah," said the manager, "you limp, malheureusement." We enrolled our names at agencies and answered advertisements, but walking everywhere made us slow, and we seemed to miss every job by half an hour. Once we very nearly got a job swabbing out railway trucks, but at the last moment they rejected us in favour of Frenchmen. Once we answered an advertisement calling for hands at a circus. You had to shift benches and clean up litter, and during the performance stand on 2 tubs and let a lion jump through your legs. When we got to the place, an hour before the time named, we found a queue of 50 men already waiting. There is some attraction in lions, evidently. Once an agency to which I had applied months earlier sent me a petit bleu, telling me of an Italian gentleman who wanted English lessons. The petit bleu said, "Come at once," and promised 20 francs an hour. Boris and I were in despair. Here was a splendid chance, and I could not take it, for it was impossible to go to the agency with my coat out at elbow. Then it occurred to us that I could wear Boris's coat. It did not match my trousers, but the trousers were grey and might pass for flannel at a short distance. The coat was so much too big for me that I had to wear it unbuttoned and keep one hand in my pocket. I hurried out and wasted 75 centimes on a bus fare to get to the agency. When I got there, I found that the Italian had changed his mind and left Paris. Once, Boris suggested that I should go to Les Halles and try for a job as a porter. I arrived at 4:30 in the morning, when the work was getting into its swing. Seeing a short fat man in a bowler hat directing some porters, I went up to him and asked for work. Before answering, he seized my right hand and felt the palm. "You're strong, eh?" he said. "Very strong," I said untruly. "Yeah, let me see you lift that crate." It was a huge wicker basket full of potatoes. I took hold of it and found that, so far from lifting it, I could not even move it. The man in the bowler hat watched me, then shrugged his shoulders and turned away. I made off. When I had gone some distance, I looked back and saw 4 men lifting the basket onto a cart. It weighed 300 weight, possibly. The man had seen that I was no use and taken this way of getting rid of me. Sometimes, in his hopeful moments, Boris spent 50 centimes on a stamp and wrote to one of his ex-mistresses asking for money. Only one of them ever replied. It was a woman who, besides having been his mistress, owed him 200 francs. When Boris saw the letter waiting and recognized the handwriting, he was wild with hope. We seized the letter and rushed up to Boris's room to read it, like a child with stolen sweets. Boris read the letter, then handed it silently to me. It ran,
"My little cherished wolf, with what delight did I open thy charming letter, reminding me of the days of our perfect love, and of the so dear kisses which I have received from thy lips. Such memories linger forever in the heart, like the perfume of a flower that is dead. As to thy request for 200 francs, alas, it is impossible. Thou dost not know, my dear one, how I am desolated to hear of thy embarrassments. But what wouldst thou? In this life which is so sad, trouble comes to every one. I too have had my share. My little sister has been ill. Ah, the poor little one, how she suffered! and we are obliged to pay I know not what to the doctor. All our money is gone, and we are passing, I assure thee, very difficult days. Courage, my little wolf, always the courage. Remember that the bad days are not for ever, and the trouble which seems so terrible will disappear at last. Rest assured, my dear one, that I will remember thee always, and receive the most sincere embraces of her who has never ceased to love thee, thy Yvonne.
This letter disappointed Boris so much that he went straight to bed, and would not look for work again that day. My 60 francs lasted about a fortnight. I had given up the pretense of going out to restaurants, and we used to eat in my room, one of us sitting on the bed and the other on the chair. Boris would contribute his 2 francs, and I 3 or 4 francs, and we would buy bread, potatoes, milk and cheese, and make soup over my spirit lamp. We had a saucepan and a coffee bowl and 1 spoon. Every day there was a polite squabble as to who should eat out of the saucepan and who out of the coffee bowl. The saucepan held more, and every day, to my secret anger, Boris gave in first and had the saucepan. Sometimes we had more bread in the evening, sometimes not. Our linen was getting filthy, and it was 3 weeks since I had had a bath. Boris, so he said, had not had a bath for months. It was tobacco that made everything tolerable. We had plenty of tobacco, for some time before Boris had met a soldier. The soldiers had given their tobacco free and bought 20 or 30 packets at 50 centimes each. All this was far worse for Boris than for me. The walking and sleeping on the floor kept his leg and back in constant pain, and with his vast Russian appetite he suffered torments of hunger, though he never seemed to grow thinner. On the whole, he was surprisingly gay, and he had vast capacities for hope. He used to say seriously that he had a patron saint who watched over him, and when things were very bad, he would search the gutter for money, saying that the saint often dropped a 2-franc piece there. One day, we were waiting in the Rue Royale. There was a Russian restaurant nearby, and we were going to ask for a job there. Suddenly, Boris made up his mind to go into the Madeleine and burn a 50-centime candle to his patron saint. Then coming out, he said that he would be on the safe side, and solemnly put a match to a 50-centime stamp, as a sacrifice to the immortal gods. Perhaps the gods and the saints did not get on together, at any rate, we missed the job. On some mornings, Boris collapsed in the most utter despair. He would lie in bed almost weeping, cursing the Jew with whom he lived. Of late, the Jew had become restive about paying the daily 2 francs, and what was worse, had begun putting on intolerable airs of patronage. Boris said that I, as an Englishman, could not conceive what torture it was to a Russian of family to be at the mercy of a Jew.
A Jew, mon ami, a veritable Jew, and he hasn't even the decency to be ashamed of it. To think that I, a captain in the Russian army, have I ever told you, mon ami, that I was a captain in the 2nd Siberian Rifles? Yes, a captain, and my father was a colonel, and here I am, eating the bread of a Jew. A Jew. I will tell you what the Jews are like. Once, in the early months of the war, we were on the march, and we had halted at a village for the night. A horrible old Jew with a red beard like Judas Iscariot came sneaking up to my billet. I asked him what he wanted. "Your honor," he said, "I have brought you a girl for you, a beautiful young girl, only 17. It will only be 50 francs. "Thank you," I said. "You can take her away again. I don't want to catch any diseases." "Diseases?" cried the Jew. "Mais, monsieur le capitaine, there's no fear of that. It's my own daughter. That is the Jewish national character for you." "Have I ever told you, mon ami, that in the old Russian army it was considered bad form to spit on a Jew?" "Yes. We thought a Russian officer's spittle was too precious to be wasted on Jews," etc., etc. On these days, Boris usually declared himself too ill to go out and look for work.
He would lie till evening in the greyish, verminous sheets, smoking and reading old newspapers. Sometimes we played chess. We had no board, but we wrote down the moves on a piece of paper, and afterwards we made a board from the side of a packing case and a set of men from buttons, Belgian coins, and the like. Boris, like many Russians, had a passion for chess. It was a saying of his that the rules of chess are the same as the rules of love and war, and that if you can win at one, you can win at the others. But he also said that if you have a chessboard, you do not mind being hungry, which was certainly not true in my case.